Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. This is Catherine Elston Fitz, and it's that time of year, the spirit of Christmas. Christmas is a holiday with very powerful culture and traditions that go back centuries. And so I invited Harry Blaser to join me in the next food series edition to discuss the culinary history of Christmas. I'm hoping that when you sit down to celebrate your Christmas dinner this year, that what Harry shares with us will also help you celebrate the spirit and tradition of the foods you enjoy. They're very, very powerful. Now, Harry built the largest fresh food market in the country before he sold it in the early 2000s. But it's fair to say, Harry, and of course, I think you know more about the grocery business than anybody on the planet, but it's fair to say whether it was at Harry's Farmers Market or in the grocery business today, Christmas is the busiest time of year. Is that not the case?
Thanksgiving and Christmas, those 2 days were major food days in the United States.
So did you ever get to eat dinner at Christmas, or did you have to just work?
Well, we were closed Christmas Day.
Ah,
closed,
okay.
And generally closed Thanksgiving Day, so we'd give those days for holidays for our employees so they can enjoy the holidays with their families.
Right. So I want to go all the way back to the beginning, before the Christians decided that they would use this period of the year to celebrate Christ's birthday. So this goes way back before Christmas was called Christmas. This goes back to the pagan and Roman holidays and the festivals and feasts. So why this time of year? Why is there such a big feast and festival at this time of year?
Well, you know the answer. So we're going to let you give it.
Because that's one of the things. You know me, I always like the deeper news. So if we're talking about Christmas food, I want to know, okay, what's the deeper news on Christmas food? So Christmas comes literally on the Roman solstice. It's the shortest day of the year. It's the day with the least sunlight. Now, we're in Montana, so it's definitely a day of least sunlight. But so this is a cold time of year. This is a time when it's the sort of the toughest on the body, it's the toughest on the immune system. And so having a feast where you celebrate abundance, where you celebrate luxury, it's a way of cutting out the dark, it's a way of cutting out the cold. It's also a way of restoring and rejuvenating people for the long winter ahead.
We might just mention that that applies only to the Northern Hemisphere.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So, in fact, when you look at what people are eating in the Northern European traditions, it's very different than when we go in and one of the things, when you go all the way back, what you see throughout the centuries is that what people are eating or using to celebrate is that which normally for the rest of the year is very luxurious. So there are two traditions. One is part of the meal is what's abundant at that time. But the other part of the meal is what's luxurious. And you know from what you know about the food business, the economics of what is abundant and what is luxurious changes over the centuries. So, for example, if you go back to medieval times in Northern Europe, you see oranges, spices, raisins, currants. These were very expensive things you had to bring in from the Mediterranean. And so they're very, very dear. Whereas now they, you know, all of our Christmases are full of spice and nutmeg and cinnamon and all these things, and they're no longer considered expensive. But the traditions relate to what was luxurious then. So
So as in everything, economics determines a lot of what ends up on the table.
A lot of it. But, you know, we always see these things. I always talk about the Armagnac. I only pull out the really good Armagnac at Christmas. And it's interesting, when I lived in New York, my gift to all my clients, I was on the board of the New York City Food Bank. I'm huge into food banks. And, you know, in New York, everybody's enjoying tremendous food luxury, but not everybody. And so all my clients would get a letter saying that we had given a contribution to the New York City Food Bank that would fund 110 pounds of food for families in need on Christmas.
So each client, basically, was giving that.
No, we would give... my clients would fund, essentially, thousands of pounds of food. The other thing I find fascinating, and this gets into what was luxurious and what was not through history, is if you... And this is back to the Northern European traditions. If you look at December, that was the period of the most abundance for meat. So a lot of the farmers didn't want to fund feed for the animals through the winter. And so they would slaughter in late fall and early winter all the animals who weren't workhorses or carriage horses or breeding animals. So whether they were work or breeding animals, everybody else, all the other animals got slaughtered. At the same time, you were in hunting season. You know, so you see fowl, you see venison, all the things that are hunted, boars. And so whether it's the slaughtering at the in the late fall or the hunting season, it's a time of peak meat. And I always remind, I don't know if you remember the scene in Dancing of Wolves when the Indians keep waiting for the buffalo and finally the buffalo come. And after they hunt the buffalo, they have a huge feast where they just eat. You know, they are consuming animal fat like vacuum cleaners.
Yeah, I was reading something about dinner at Shakespeare. This was the name of a book.
Uh-huh.
And they talked about what was there for dinner and then what was there for later that evening or whatever. It's like seven courses of meat or something.
Yeah, if you go back to medieval times, the percentage of the Christmas feast that came from meat was very, very high, whereas the percent that came from different kinds of fruits or dried fruits or spices was, you know, because it was dear, it was much more expensive. So the one that makes me laugh is mince pie. Mincemeat pie was always a big thing in my grandparents' house. And so if you look at what was in mincemeat pie and go back to the beginning, it was almost all meat. Now it's no meat. You know, then the raisins and the spices were very expensive. And so, but through the period as they became more economic, you know, now, have you ever seen a mincemeat pie with real meat in it?
In some rare situations in like farmer's markets where they're trying to recreate a traditional mince pie, but otherwise it's turned into basically some sort of fruitcake in a pie that you heat up with some goo.
And the last thing that really strikes me, because Christmas is something that has been sort of morphed around the world and through the ages. If you look at around the world, at all the different places that celebrate Christmas, and you look at the diversity of the food, it's extraordinary, and these traditions spread. So the one I love, because I love turkey, and the conquistadors brought turkey back from the Americas to Europe, and then it spread throughout Europe, and the Brits picked it up for Christmas, and then the Puritans brought it back to Massachusetts. And so when they got to Massachusetts, they looked at the woods, and the woods was full of wild turkeys, and they're like, oh wow, we know what that, you know, we know what that is. But yet one of the things I didn't know until we started to work on this together was it wasn't until 1955 in America, in the United States, that turkey surpassed chicken as the number one food at Christmas. And so until 1955, it was chickens, it wasn't turkey.
And maybe did the butterball turkey have anything to do with
it? Well, I have to bring this up because, you know, one of the things that I try very hard to get every Salieri Report subscriber to do is to listen to Adam Trombley's interview that he did with me on entrainment. And so most Salieri Report subscribers know Adam Trombley. So I have to mention this little Salieri Report food factoid is that Adam Trombley's dad left the intelligence agencies. You know, he was like, I'm out of here. And he ended up going to work for Swift and he invented the butterball turkey. But it was when they plumped up the turkeys that turkey became very attractive, I'm betting, because the per pound of the meat was probably very competitive with chicken.
Is this part of the, if we can get those intelligence agency guys to be more productive, we'll end up with a lot more things like butterball turkeys, right?
Well, but one of the reasons I love living in New York, one of my favorite Christmases ever was in 1978, the first year I worked in New York. I was there for the summer in 77, but then I went to work on Wall Street. And, of course, I was working hard, and I'd spent all my money to get my apartment. And I got a great studio apartment at 64th and Madison, which was kind of miraculous. And the day before birth, before Christmas is my birthday, which is always why I make such a big deal out of all my life. I've been celebrating Christmas as though it was my birthday. And so I decided to take the day off and just wander through the city and see both for trees and food what was there. And I had never in my life seen the diversity of tradition, because New York has always been a city which preserves its ethnic traditions. And particularly you had the Northern European and the Eastern European traditions all represented. And it was remarkable. I'd never seen anything like it. And then, of course, the Christmas trees and the tree at Rockefeller Center. But it was it you saw in one day and in one city the unbelievable diversity of Christmas foods from all over the world. And it was mind-boggling. I told you I barely ate because it was just so deeply satisfying looking at
all
of it.
Too hard to make a choice.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, you talked about meat. One of the things I was always fascinated about is how the goose became such a tradition.
Right.
And it's maybe not as much of a modern tradition in the United States, but it's been a huge tradition
in Europe.
In a lot of places for a long time, and continues to be in Europe. So I came across some stuff. Some of this stuff is pretty interesting. Geese are ready to be eaten twice a year, once when they are young or green in the early summer, and again when they are at their fattest and ripest toward the end of the year after having feasted on fallen corn. It also has the softest fat in its category of animal. The fat turns to liquid at 111 degrees, as opposed to duck fat at 126, for example, making it easier to cook and its fat easier to consume. Try it on pancakes, they said.
Oof.
They were thus, it's almost looked at as gold.
Right.
Goose fat is absolutely. Right. They were thus used as the centerpiece at Michaelmas, a feast day celebrated during the Middle Ages, which fell on the winter solstice and honored the end of the harvest and the change in season. Earlier than that, roast goose was an offering to Odin and Thor in thanks for the harvest. It was also richly eaten in ancient Greek culture in order to ensure the crops in the months to come. It was only natural for goose to become the roast of choice for the Christmas, which eventually took the place of other winter solstice festivities. For the American settlers, turkey took goose's place because that's what happened to be living on their new home soil, and followed the same pattern of maturation. So goose has been around for a long time. What's interesting, too, is like for the wealthy folks in Europe, lots of times, they would eat things like swan, even.
And peacock.
Right.
Yeah.
And peacocks.
Right.
So, like, apart from the wild and tame fowl for everyday consumption, there are a few which were outstanding as celebratory birds for feasts and festivals. These were swans and peacocks among the rich, and herons and bustards for those less well off. The peacock made a fine show on a festive occasion, more usual than peacock at feasts of the nobility or swans. And so that was from the Food and Drink in Britain from the Stone Age to the 19th century. That's a pretty interesting book.
You know, if you're in Europe, you see so much more goose and fowl eaten than here, or diversity of fowl eaten than here.
The goose, which the Celts had kept for pleasure, were probably of the gray leg variety, which has remained the principal domestic goose of Britain. Goose was in season twice in its life, a young goose in early summer, and then fattened birds at Michaelmas. That's from Food in Britain from the Stone Age to the 19th century again. So this has been a major, major tradition. As a matter of fact, there are even goose clubs. The Christmas bird provided by the familiar goose club may be compared with the German Montanmas goose. And on and on. So there's even these societies that grew up around gooses and raising goose and their kind of goose and so on.
So I've never had goose at Christmas. Should we cook goose this year?
Well, it's actually, you know, one of the things I find about these traditions is that it involves using precious commodities oftentimes.
Right. Right.
But also it takes a lot of care.
Right.
To make this stuff.
Right.
And goose is one of them. I mean, we can put a recipe from D'Artagnan, which was a meat supplier of mine and well-respected in New York. There's quite a bit to it. But
oh,
I think
really?
If you follow, yeah, but if you follow this, you end up with something that's quite special.
Right.
So we'll give people the option anyways. So there was some interesting food experiences that you had around the holiday times you wanted to share.
Right. So when we started to discuss this, I sat down and I said, what were my favorite Christmas meals? What were the best that I've ever had? And it was great fun because there have been many, but one was, I was about 5 years ago, I was in Vienna for business right before Christmas. And I don't know if you've ever been in Vienna at Christmas, but it is absolutely wonderful. The whole town is decked out in the most beautiful Christmas decorations. And, the weather's perfect. It's kind of winter wonderland. And they have little log cabins that they put up in Christmas markets all over the town. There are literally thousands of them in different clusters of markets. And I had a subscriber in Vienna, a wonderful subscriber who I'd never met in person. And we had brunch, and then we couldn't stop talking. So she said, do you want to have some mulled wine? I said, what's mulled wine? And it gets back to the spices. You know, so it's hot wine with spices. And so we went out to the Christmas markets. And there are hundreds of these round tables like you would have at a bar, stand up. And there were literally, the whole city, Harry, seemed as though it was outside drinking mulled wine. And so we started drinking mulled wine right after lunch, and we kept talking and talking, and finally we realized it was time for dinner. So we wanted to walk by the Lipizzaner stables and then went out and had dinner. But what was so wonderful about it was it literally felt like the whole city was either serving mulled wine, cooking mulled wine, or drinking mulled wine and standing out. And I've never felt like I was part of a more human culture celebrating the pleasure of each other's company.
So here, Germanfoods.org talks about 10 beloved German Christmas traditions. And one of them is mulled wine.
Mulled wine.
Glühwein, I guess. On a cold day, nothing will warm you up faster than a mug of steaming hot Glühwein. This quintessential Christmas beverage consists of hot mulled red wine with an optional shot of brandy. Most major cities in Germany serve it in ceramic mugs designed specifically for the local Christmas markets.
Right.
Similar to the practice in Bavaria beer gardens, when you pay a deposit in addition to the price of the beverage, you can then either return the mug once finished to get your deposit back or keep it as a nice souvenir. So it's a major part of that time of year. It's also a major part of those markets,
right?
Which is also another German tradition,
right?
That went all over Europe. So a few more German traditions: Advent calendar. Do you know what an Advent calendar is?
I have one every year.
So yeah, I think we introduced them in the South.
Really?
So we used to bring over container loads from Germany.
Did you have advent calendars where you get a piece of chocolate
every day? Yeah, you get 24 days. You open it up and you're right. and then also, I mean, the Germans invented, from what I understand, the Christmas tree.
Yeah, the Germans.
Right?
Yeah,
and they also came up with the Advent wreath, which was kind of like they kept the Christmas tree for Christmas Day, and then you'd have this wreath, right. And they'd light a candle like every 7 days or something. And then they have this, basically St. Nicholas kind of came out of their whole traditions.
St. Nicholas and Father Christmas came from Germany and the Dutch.
So here they've also got this character that's going around with St. Nicholas. His assistant is Necht Ruprecht. Well, so they leave little gifts, but then that's also where the tradition of leaving some coal for the bad kids, came up. Because like he was the bad actor, and St. Nicholas was the good guy. So here, while St. Nicholas dresses similarly to his American counterpart, he does not drive a sleigh or come down the chimney. In some households, children may actually come face to face with Nicholas. The imposing saint, played by a family friend, asks the children whether they have been naughty or nice. Lying is pointless because St. Nicholas knows everything. He carries around a record of each and every child's good and bad behavior in the Golden Book. This is a good control mechanism by the parents. His assistant, Knecht Ruprecht, is a menacing figure whose role is to frighten children into good behavior with threats of being spanked. However, St. Nicholas is a good-hearted character who simultaneously exudes gentleness and authority. So, and then Kris Kringle kind of ends up coming from that. So how did St. Nicholas become popularly known as Kris Kringle? With the Reformation came a movement away from the worship of saints, and the tradition of giving and opening gifts was moved to Christmas Eve. Ever since the tradition is that gifts are thought of as having been brought by the Christ kind, Christ child. This is how Kris Kringle derived his name. It's an incorrect anglicization of Kris kind.
Right.
In Germany, presents are now usually opened on Christmas Eve, December 24th, after a traditional family meal and the singing of Christmas carols similar to North America.
You know, the Puritans were very opposed to Christmas and did everything they could to stop it.
Maybe because they weren't drinking enough mulled wine.
it finally got by them. But one of the things I was going to tell you, that my, and this is a very Southern tradition, my father's threat, and he was from Tennessee, my father's threat was the only thing that was going to be in our stockings was switches and ashes. Switches
but he
and
used
ashes.
To work for the intelligence agencies, right?
you take all the ashes at the bottom of the fire and you dump them into the stockings, and that's what a bad kid gets.
You know, you're also talking about sugar as being very expensive. And actually, not only was it expensive, but right. It was also looked at medicinally.
Right.
You know, they thought it could cure all kinds of diseases at some point. And there's even a long tradition that goes back to Muslim physicians. But what's quite interesting is the candy cane, which is another German invention.
I didn't know that. I've never known where the candy cane came from.
Well, supposedly, according to folklore, in 1670, in Cologne, Germany, the choir master at the Cologne Cathedral,
really?
wishing to remedy the noise caused by children in his church during the Livin Kresh tradition of Christmas Eve, asked a local candy maker for some sweet sticks for them. In order to justify the practice of giving candy to children during worship services, he asked the candy maker to add a crook to the top of each stick, which would help children remember the shepherds who visit the infant Jesus.
Really? So,
and then it goes on about how these, you know, the tradition develops, and they start learning how to mass produce it and so on. And then the Bundt brothers got involved in the United States, McCormick Candy, which eventually became Bob's, which is the largest producer of candy canes now in the world. But what also is pretty interesting is that there was a Roman Catholic priest who in 1957 patented his invention called the Keller machine. His name was Keller. That basically automated the process of twisting soft candy into spiral stripping. Striping and cutting it into precise length as candy canes. So
it's very interesting because we can criticize all the different entrepreneurs who commercialize Christmas, but when you look at the food traditions, what you realize, it's those efforts that have really made a huge contribution to bringing the price down.
Absolutely.
Right.
So, I mean, you could argue that so much of economic history is about making abundant what was
luxurious, right?
What was scarce,
right?
And yeah, we've done a pretty good job of it. Now we're going full circle, right? Abundance in the United States does not necessarily equate with quality,
right? Right.
So ginger,
yeah.
Another spice.
One of my favorite things in the world, ginger.
Okay, so I wondered, well, how did ginger, like gingerbread houses, how that become such a big deal? So I was reading, this comes from Wikipedia, you know, records of honey cakes can be traced to ancient Rome. Food historians ratify that ginger has been seasoning foodstuffs and drinks since antiquity. And then it believed gingerbread was first baked in Europe at the end of the 11th century. When returning crusaders brought back the custom of spicy bread from Middle East.
Right.
Ginger was not only tasty, it had properties that helped preserve the bread. According to the French legend, gingerbread was brought to Europe in 1992 by the Armenian monk, later saint, Gregory of Nicopolis, also known as Gregory Makar. He lived for 7 years in Bondaroy, France, near the town of so-and-so, and goes on and on. And, you know, it becomes Lebkuchen, it becomes all different kinds of things. But then you've got like a gigantic history then of these guilds growing up in 16th and 17th century. And there's all kinds of professional guys shaping gingerbread and even laws that say you can't shape gingerbread unless you're one of these professionals.
Really?
Yeah, except around Christmas time and Easter. Then everybody could do it. So it becomes this huge this huge industry, but also it becomes an amazing
artisan.
Artistic, right?
Yeah,
artisan.
An artisan.
Artistic endeavor. So it, these traditions, like you said, as Christmas itself, these traditions go back to pagan times. And, you know, part of the genius, I guess, of Christians is that they figured out what needed to be incorporated into Christian religion, you might say, to get the masses interested in participating.
Right. It's funny. One of the things, one of my favorite food series interviews is the interview you did with Francois Vecchio, and he really brings out the power of artisan expertise in food and the importance. And when you look at the history, the culinary history of Christmas, what you see again and again is the artisans inventing and really developing all of these different amazing foods. And it's what I saw in New York, because you had a very rich artisan population at that time still in New York. So it almost makes me want to ask the question, how is that artisan tradition going to stay alive and continue to be revitalized?
Well, as Mr. Vecchio was talking about, there is a true rejuvenation happening.
Right. Right.
It's totally grassroots. It's coming from dedicated individuals who then partner through blogs and associations, and you know, to develop and to share knowledge. And now there's some amazingly good stuff. The problem is that the ingredients have been so bastardized,
right,
that you can have excellent quality charcuterie, for example, but you can't find non-GMO, you know, meat to go.
Right.
To go in the thing.
Right.
So now it's the artisans are coming back strong. We just need now those ingredients to make those artisanal products something you could eat.
Right.
So let me tell you about another a German tradition, food tradition, that, and actually we sold this in our stores. And I think we might have been the first ones to bring into the South also. It's called the Stollen. It's spelled S-T-O-L-L-E-N. It's got the two dots over the O oftentimes. It's related to foods like panettone, fruitcake, and so on, developed in Europe during the medieval times. And cook of all times and places, you know, save special ingredients for use for special occasions. These special holiday yeast cakes were made with the cook's finest wheat flour, white sugar, butter, eggs, dried fruit, and so on. And when I go to the food shows in Europe and took a look at the ingredients and also asked around, the best cakes were made supposedly in Dresden. That's the city that had that heritage. And like from the Oxford Companion of Food, they say the characteristic shape of the Stollen, oblong, tapered at each end with a ridge down the center, is said to represent the Christ child in swaddling clothes, whence the name Christollen, sometimes given to it. The Dresden Stollen, now known internationally as a Christmas specialty, is made from a rich, sweet yeast dough mixed with milk, egg, sugar, and butter, sometimes flavored with lemon, raisins, sultanas, currants, rum or brandy, candied peel, and almonds are worked into the dough. After baking, the Stollen is painted with melted butter and dusted with sugar, and may be further decorated with candied fruits.
The only problem is this, when you started to describe it, I got hungry and started thinking about how I could get it shipped in.
Yeah, and this is one from Dresden that was particularly good that you could get. So
that you sold at Harry's?
Oh, yeah.
You'd have it shipped in from Germany?
Oh, yeah, we bring in containers of this stuff.
Yeah, wow.
And another thing, which of course wasn't from Germany, it was from Italy that we brought in, and I'm not sure that we introduced it, but we used to sell a huge amount of these panettones, of course, which is the Italian tan cake. It's panettone, or great big bread loaf, is a large dome yeast dough with a density of aroma that belies its light but firm texture, with golden yellow interior and a browned outer surface, a top sprinkled with candied sugar, and the inside studded with dried fruit and candied peels. The mixture is rich with sugar, honey, butter, and eggs. perfume of vanilla and sometimes liqueurs, and has a softness and lightness that makes it an ideal cake to have around at Christmas time.
Wow.
So that's from the Oxford Companion to Italian Food. I guess the English get involved with everybody's culinary history, don't they? And it's the industrial production of panettone originated in Milan, and ours was always from Milan also, in the 1920s, when Angelo Motta, which is actually one of the one of the most well-known brands today even, and Giacomo Alemagna, which is another brand that's known very well today, started producing them. And now they are made all over Italy. But before then, Artusi had annoyed some of his readers by printing a version perfected by his cook, Marietta Sabatini, using bicarbonate soda and cream of tartar baking powder instead of fresh yeast. So one can deduce that the Milanese version was already known, loved, and passionately defended in the early years of the 20th century. So you had... Did you talk about all your wonderful food experiences?
Did I talk about the cheese grits?
Yeah, cheese grits. You got to tell that one.
Okay, well, my when I moved to Tennessee, one of the reasons I moved was my very beloved stepmother was here. Her nickname was Mama Ta. And she was a member of a high Episcopalian church, St. Luke's. And so on Christmas, they
weren't getting high all the time.
It's just very
highfalutin, right?
Highfalutin. Yeah. And a wonderful church, wonderful church. And, you know, nobody does Christmas decorations like the Episcopalians. I mean, that's just what you need to understand. So the church would be totally decked out, but on Christmas Eve, they would have a midnight service. And it was quite beautiful in terms of candlelight service and music. And but whenever it was over... Before I could return home to Hickory Valley, I had to take Stella out to get cheese grits. Now, there's only one place you can get cheese grits in Jackson, Tennessee, and that is the Waffle House, which is right on the interstate. So you walk into the Waffle House, and there is everybody who's driving late home, you know, in Waffle House, trying to get a meal, and there is Stella, you know, with her diamond rings, wanting cheese grits. But... you know, every time we would do that, we would go down to Waffle House and have cheese grits. And cheese grits, both on Christmas and New Year's, is just an absolutely loved tradition. And I don't know, well, of course you've had cheese grits, but if anybody listening to this has never had cheese grits, it's a must.
Okay, so here's your choice now for main course this Christmas. Which one are you going to choose? Prime rib, which is very traditional down south.
Really?
I sold a lot of it. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It competed with turkey.
Did you sell more prime ribs or more turkey?
Maybe,
or ham.
Maybe. And then, of course, the Christmas ham.
Yeah. See, in Hickory Valley, it's ham.
Okay. And or a fowl, like a goose.
Right.
So, okay. So this Christmas, which one do you want?
I don't know. The goose sounds really interesting, but it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. I think I'm going to go with the prime ribs.
Okay,
so,
prime ribs is fine.
See, well, we may be together for Christmas, so we'll cook a goose and some prime rib. So anything else you'd like to share?
Yeah, because I think the most insightful comment, I really wanted to do a culinary history of Christmas at this time, because I just thought this last year has been so intense, and a lot of that intensity has been very serious, and I just wanted... to celebrate something in our lives, which is wonderful. And so I started to talk with you about tradition, the tradition of Christmas, what it's about, the spirit of Christmas, how important family is and community. And you said, yeah, it's all the things that were being attacked all year long. And I hadn't realized that. But if you look at the history of food through Christmas, what you realize that the rich culture and traditions behind our culinary history are in fact those that there's been great effort to tear them down. And I think what I'm trying to say is we need to build those back up.
And, you know, we've just touched, we're not giving a real history of the thing because you could go on for hours and hours and there's encyclopedias written about this stuff. And Christians are all over the world and those traditions in the Southern Hemisphere Far East and other places.
Right, haven't touched on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just gigantic amounts of interesting food. But, you know, people go out of their way to do something special. They go out of their way to do something special with family and friends. And it's a source of real pride. It's a source of real communion. It's a source of real community.
Right.
And those are the things that build strength.
Right.
From family up.
Right. So we're the pro-human group at the Salier Report.
Yeah, the pro-decentralization team and the pro-human team.
Right.
Now that transhumanism is becoming in vogue, we're rooting for the humans. And that goes back to real food.
Right. So let's celebrate real food and real humans at Christmas this year. So, Harry, I'm going to be seeing you for Christmas. But for those of you I won't be seeing, have a wonderful, happy Christmas and New Year's. Any last words, Harry?
You've said it. Joy to the world.
And peace on earth, goodwill to men.
There you go. Thank you.